Our first speaker is going to be Dr. Jonathan Samuel Ross, who is an MD, MPH. Dr. Ross is Associate Clinical Professor of Internal Medicine at the University of Toledo College of Medicine and past President of Physicians for National Health Program. He teaches and practices internal medicine at Mercy St. Vincent Medical Center in Toledo, Ohio. John?
Good afternoon. So, my wife got an email this morning. It's a classic movie review. And it's a small girl lands in a strange place and immediately murders an older woman, only to later kill again. Subplot, two women argue over shoes. Anybody want to take a guess? That's The Wizard of Oz. And the reason I bring it up, and this will kind of go back to kind of a theme, which is that I'd like to kind of use as, which is actually from The Wizard of Oz, which is, bring me the witch's broom. Bring me the witch's broom. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. I am Oz, the great and terrible. Bring me the witch's broom. And so I'm going to talk about malpractice, which is one of the many witch's brooms that we physicians are so caught up in and think, you know, gosh, if it only wasn't for all that trouble that we have with the issues around malpractice, then costs would be controlled and we would have better access to care. So other than the usual personal savings that probably are invested in nasty corporations all over the world, I have no conflicts of interest to confess to. So quick review, you probably know most of this stuff. Healthcare costs in the U.S. now exceed more than $2.6 million. It's up to almost 2.8, I think is the latest projection, more than 17% of our GDP. Almost 15 million Americans with no health insurance. They are at increased risk of death, disability, suffering, poor outcomes because of that lack of coverage. And it still remains unclear whether our latest and hard struggle for and barely won Affordable Care Act is actually going to significantly reduce the problems of the uninsured. And what we may find is that we've got issues with implementation, especially after next Tuesday, depending on who wins the election. So ain't no done deal by any stretch. On the other hand, when I go out and speak all the time, which I do to my physician colleagues about health reform and about single-payer national health insurance, which I believe is the single best idea for curing our problems that I just outlined. All the time, malpractice comes up over and over again among my colleagues. I've got a letter here. Thanks. So, you know, let's learn something about it. Let's dig into it. Let's actually get to the facts so that when I do go out to present these things, and maybe you'll run into these things in your own work, both as clinicians or as public health advocates, that we know what the facts are and that we can kind of respond to these things in an appropriate way. Well, we got people like Newt Gingrich and Rick Perry and Coburn from Oklahoma, who's a senator, all saying these things out loud within the last year, you know, that, you know, the only reason, if we could just get malpractice reform, they would control the soaring costs of healthcare. And other opinion leaders, including the last several presidents of the AMA, are making very similar comments as well in very public places like, you know, the AMA's NewsRag, or guys like Charles Krauthammer, who, believe it or not, is a doctor doing it in the Washington Post. So if we actually look, this has obviously been on physicians' agendas for a while. This is not a new thing. They've been complaining about it for quite some time, and we came out of a malpractice, in quote, crisis, 10 years ago. Particularly, I think, in Pennsylvania, it was a huge issue, barely able to get insurance for anyone as an OB. So it was clearly a problem, and not to be dismissed, and we can talk more about the solutions to that real problem later on. But many states in this last decade have undertaken substantial tort reform, including caps on punitive damages, removing the joint and severable liability changes, which means that you can't have multiple people paying for the same tort action. They changed the way they calculate interest, so if you lose a case and it goes to appeal, then the money you were supposed to pay as a physician goes into a fund, and there's a certain interest rate. Well, we're going down to some real detailed levels here where they're supposedly reforming these things to cut the costs of malpractice. Collateral source rules, in other words, if you've got insurance for certain health issues, the injured party has to have ongoing health care, and that's one of the things that enters in. That's why it's so expensive for OBs to get malpractice insurance, for those of you who don't understand it. It's a lifetime of care, because we don't guarantee health insurance to everybody in America. It's a lifetime of care that you have to provide for in that malpractice context. So collateral source review rule reform is you don't have to pay if the person has insurance. You don't have to build that into the damages. And then the non-economic damage caps, and even, you know, this sort of appeal bond to make sure that you don't abscond without paying your dues. If you lose a case, you have to put up a bond while the case is being appealed. So all these things have already been done, and there's been substantial reforms in more than 35 states now already. So I'm going to review a little bit of the literature that's already out there that comes from a different context, which is talking about what's happened within insurance, malpractice insurance in the private insurance sector with corporate employees who have insurance through their jobs. And then I'm going to come back to a different database and kind of show you some data that I've collected. This guy named Abraham, who works down in Texas, who's done substantial analyses, is well-respected, more to the right than the left on all this stuff. And he's looked at the impact of tort reform in states that have already had some element of state-level reform. And basically, he did find that there was a small but real impact on the order of 1% to 2% in reduction of costs for those employers, and large employers, not for individuals, but for large employers, in terms of the overall costs that they would incur as employers for health insurance premiums. Not a very big impact. So the states with the most health reform, malpractice reform, 1% to 2%. And this is, like I said, from somebody who's a fairly right-of-center economist. He looked a little bit at young people who had individual coverage rather than corporate coverage as well, and didn't really find much an effect at all. There's been a lot of additional studies. A researcher named Mello and the Congressional Budget Office, through their research branch, at request of Congress people, have looked at all this stuff. And almost everybody comes to the same conclusions, which is there's a very small impact on cost. The literature is also replete with people who are saying, you know, these malpractice reforms, taking the burden off the physicians, you know, you may be want to be careful what you wish for, because if you take away that restraint so that the physicians don't have at least a little bit of thought about, gee, something bad could happen to me if I don't provide the best care to this patient, that there may be people who will try to slide by with less than the best. And we know now, both in certain HMO contexts, and in certainly the new accountable care organization contexts, that doing less will make you more money as a clinician. You will be bonused if you're capitated, if you spend less money. So certainly in this country, where we've got a system that encourages clinicians perhaps in that capitated environment to provide less care, the malpractice may be the only balance that's out there to prevent clinicians from being less than fully cautious about their decision making. So we actually could create more costs from letting people get sick than you would actually save on malpractice. At least there's a few researchers who've said the same thing. One of the things that's unquestionable that you can see is that malpractice premiums in those states with substantial malpractice reform have dropped substantially. In my own state of Ohio, you know, it went down several thousand dollars per year and have remained relatively flat. So there's no question that malpractice reform has benefited clinicians in terms of their out-of-pocket costs for their malpractice insurance. But what we don't see is that these savings are large enough to have had much of an impact on overall costs, or perhaps the clinicians aren't sharing those savings by lowering their fees. I would almost be willing to bet a lot that they aren't. And then lastly, I want to at least acknowledge that there are some psychological impacts that are part of this. And actually, I think we'll come back to that kind of toward the end of the talk, because I want to show you some data that I've collected. How important or significant it is, I'll leave up to you. It's not a big sample of different analyses that I've done here, and it's not very powerful statistics, but you can draw your own conclusions. You've got two databases. You've got the Kaiser Family Foundation that has a database of state health care costs, and you've got the American Tort Reform Association that has a database of tort reforms. And what I did is I took those two databases and blended them together to look at whether the number of tort reforms, significant tort reforms in each state, correlated in any way with costs or access issues. So if you look between 2007 and 2009, when many of these tort, and this is a little complex, and the data is dirty because the states were doing individual types of reform at different times over this last decade, so it gets a little dirty. You can't really connect the dots as well as one might like. But what you can see is there's virtually no correlation between the number of tort reforms, those are those 50 dots or the 50 states, okay, between the number of tort reforms along the bottom and the number of uninsured in a given state. So no change really for those states that have lots of tort reform, not a lot of difference in the number of uninsured. If you look at tort reforms versus the percent increase in family premiums from 2006 to 2010, some of this data is a little asymmetric again because of the databases. Again, not much of a correlation, relatively straight line. If you look at the number of tort reforms versus the average annual percent increase in costs in those states, again, not much of a correlation. If you look at the number of tort reforms versus the cost per hospital day in 2010, which, you know, we would have expected at the end of that decade of reform that we might have seen some changes in that, and the states that had more tort reform versus the states that didn't, no correlation. The number of tort reforms versus the percent growth in the cost per capita by state, and actually there's now some data on 2010, which I'll add at some point, but, you know, basically, again, no correlation. So the older data, not done on a broader perspective, certainly did not show much of an impact of tort reform on costs, and we certainly don't have much evidence here that it's making much difference in costs or access. So I don't think it'll do much good to bring the witch's broom to this situation. You know, bringing the witch's broom, the tort reform, you know, and dealing with these issues of complaints of clinicians that, you know, it's all about malpractice, and if we just would do something about malpractice, costs would come down, therefore access would increase. I'm sorry, it just is not true. Not by any of the traditional highly intensive, highly trained researchers, or by my sort of short and dirty study. So how would I conclude here? I think that a couple of things we should really recognize. The tort reform system is terribly dysfunctional. 60% of what we spend on our malpractice premiums goes to sorting out whether the case will go forward or not. Most of that going to the insurance companies in terms of their overhead and to the lawyers who are working to sort it out. The other 40%, a good chunk of it would go away if we simply had a universal healthcare system that covered everyone, because a substantial piece of our malpractice premium goes for the ongoing care of the uninsured. Those costs would simply go away. We need to develop a culture of safety, not a system of adversarial arguments over whether you did something good or bad. And I think there's some element of that underway. I'm seeing system changes in my own hospital. I think there is more of a culture of safety developing. It has yet to reach the outpatient environment, but I suspect that it will reach the outpatient environment at some point, and we'll begin to see that, if nothing else, might make some difference in actually the quality of the care that we provide, and perhaps even save us some money. And the cost savings from our current tort reform have probably resulted in very modest, if any at all, savings. And so I'll come to this last conclusion, which is I think that there is something about malpractice that creates a psychological environment for clinicians that we're not addressing. There's a psychopathology here of sorts. You know, we are anxious. And what is going on here? This is the breaking of trust between the clinician and the patient. And the more we move our system in the direction of physicians having a financial interest in the type of care, rather than being completely financially divorced from the decisions about care, the more likely it is that the people that we're serving will see our actions as being commercial rather than our caring actions. And so I think that a lot of the emotionality that flows behind this malpractice stuff is actually a psychopathology of sorts in my colleagues and maybe even in myself. And I think it needs to be addressed. So a couple more conclusions and I'm done. The usual drivers of high costs are going to remain pretty much the same. We've got an aging population. That's not bad. That's a success. You know, that's good, right? You know? It's going to cost us more because as you get older, you accumulate more illnesses, you know, so in a sense, that's a success. The poor lifestyle choices, we talked a little bit about this. You have to remember those lifestyle choices are embedded in a culture that makes the bad path the greased path. You know, in America, we pay people to do the wrong thing and then complain about it. You know, we need to make sure that our incentives are within our culture, are aligned in a way that keeps us healthy and in a way that we protect and share these things with each other. I think that there's no question that growth in duplicated and expensive but only marginally beneficial technologies is a problem. But new technology is desirable. It just needs to be assessed and appropriately distributed and recognized for its costs versus its benefits. The real waste, of course, as two of my colleagues sitting in the back have pointed out, is in the administrative waste of the American system, which consumes pushing onto a third of our healthcare dollars. We have an army of bureaucrats that are trying to figure out a more and more complicated system, and so now we're going to have ACOs. It'll be even more complicated, and what do we need? More administrators to administer an even more complicated system. I think that we're on the wrong path. We need simple, not more complex. And we need the simplicity of a single-payer national health insurance. And I think that the high prices that America face reflect mostly number 3 and 4 on that list. And just to remind you, at every level, that a system is often perfectly designed to give exactly the results that it gives, and there's multiple people who that's attributed to. I couldn't actually find who the original attribute was on this. But, you know, we have a perfectly designed system to spend $2.8 trillion and to leave 50 million people uninsured. It's perfectly designed to kill, pushing on to 50,000 people a year from uninsurance alone. And what stands in the way? We stand in the way. Unless you've given up on democracy, unless you've given up on action to change it. So I would call to you, given we're talking about activism in an election year, do not let your voices be quiet. We need to speak out to these injustices every time we see them. We need to speak truth to power. So thanks.